Hi everyone, this is Keegan for GM Talks. I'm here with Matthew Dawkins, and we want to talk about The World Below. And I said it right this time, because I keep wanting to say worlds. But Ooh. Welcome back, Matthew.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Keegan. It's always lovely to be here. And so, yeah, the Worlds Below would be a different game, but one I'm now very enticed by. Maybe if The World Below does well enough, we'll do a sequel, which, you know, a movie, Hollywood tells us something right now is that to make a sequel, you need to do is add an S on the end. Although I say that like that's some truism. Predators did it. Aliens, I suppose. No, there's not been a Halloween's yet. It's just been Halloween kills and ends and things like that. But anyway, yes. The World Below is Onyx Path's new subterranean fantasy role-playing game that mixes the narrative strength of storytelling with the mechanical heft and lethality of OSR. It is deliberately designed with the express purpose of being a world-sized dungeon crawl that pairs monster slaying, excavation, and exploration with base building, construction, and resource gathering. So there's a lot going on in there, but it's in a lot of ways a tribute to my love for a lot of the games that got me into the hobby. Things like Tunnels and Trolls, AD&D, and OSR games that have emerged since, certainly. But with the storytelling element that, of course, I love from World of Darkness and the story path games that we get to work on at Onyx Path, like Scion Trinity and They Came From. So there's a lot of influences, a lot of ideas that go into this, but it seems to be doing very well on Backerkit, which is lovely to see.
Yeah, I can say this now that I ran it, is because I'll be very honest with you in that I did not enjoy running Trinity Aeon. It just did not click with me. And
oh,
I thought
that's fine.
And I thought Scion was just okay. I actually liked They Came From, but I could only see myself doing one shots. And if you're going to get one ringing endorsement from me about this game, it is the first story path game that I'm like, I could run a campaign of this game. So,
well, that, I mean, that is excellent to hear. It's using StoryPath Ultra, which is our revised version of the StoryPath system. We have definitely learned from Trinity, Scion, and They Came From, and Dystopia Rising Evolution, for that matter, about what works, what doesn't, what things the players use and story guides use, which things they leave because they're either too complex or just too superfluous. And so StoryPath Ultra is definitely a refinement, which we'll see appearing in future games as well. But no, that's wonderful to hear. And when people say They Came From is best suited to one-shots, I don't disagree. I think the immediate inclination with a game that is based around the cinematic experience, making a movie, essentially, you have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You present that within a 3 or 4 hour slot, and that's your game. Something I found a great deal of success with, probably the most success with They Came From wise for campaign games, is the upcoming They Came From Classified, which we crowdfunded over a year ago. And it should be coming out very, very soon to backers. It's our espionage movie game, and I'm trying to reflect that in some of our upcoming releases, our tasty bits, we call them, at Onyx Path, where in January there will be one that is essentially a Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy style story, where you've got to find the mole within your organization, and that will then lead you on to the agency or the organization, the opposition alphabet agency that this mole is working for. And so the second part is you are involving yourself with them and finding out where they lead to and so on. And it's still episodic in the same way that a TV show or movies, where, to use the Daniel Craig Bond films as an example, how Mads Mikkelsen's character links to Quantum and how Quantum links to Spectre. You know, you may not like the movies necessarily, A lot of people don't. But the sequential nature, it really works well for a game like Classified. But anyway, I know we're not here to speak about They Came From, but I do agree with you fundamentally. It's They Came From is a game that definitely strikes a one-shot chord for a lot of people.
Yeah, and this one, because I do like the resource gathering, and I like basically the Citadel building, like from older editions of D&D. If this does do well, do you think you'll expand that? Because I know, because Forbidden Lands has a pretty robust home base building system now in it, because that was also the point of that system, and I'm wondering if you're thinking of ways to expand there.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Birthright. I'm a big fan of Pendragon. I think there's probably a lot of Pendragon that appears in The World Below. That's, again, by design. I've always enjoyed the dynasty building, the fiefdom expansion, the random rolls that you get during things like winter phases to see what disaster or what blessings sort of befalls your community and seeing how you respond to it. And whether you get dilapidated by plague or whether you suddenly, you know, every woman in the fiefdom gets pregnant, that kind of thing. I love that kind of thing because it creates a feeling of an expanded world within the game you're playing. A lot of games, of course, focus entirely on the party, the player characters, and that is absolutely fine. Most games I play and run do. But often it can result in them not necessarily feeling grounded in the world around them. These are characters that will embark on adventures, and when they're not on adventures, they're waiting for the next adventure. With games such as you mentioned, such as Pendragon, such as A Song of Ice and Fire, for that matter, by Green Ronin, there is an element where, okay, your adventuring is done, now it's time to build the home base, make sure your people are well, make sure that the right resources are being gathered, make sure that you can outlast the coming winter, or in The World Below's case, the chaos storms and monster hordes and things like that. It makes for a cyclical kind of game, but it adds a depth of time and, I think, importance to what your characters are doing. And, of course, feeds into generational play, too. Which is another thing I enjoy a great deal.
Yeah, no, I saw that, and then I'm wondering if this was intentional. It almost seems like you have three fundamental forces in The World Below, similar to, like, World of Darkness, because you've had the Abyss, the Dark, and Chaos. Was that intentional?
No, I wouldn't say it was intentional, but it may well have been subconscious. The Abyss is obviously a fairly ubiquitous term for like a primordial darkness or destructive element, and so that felt natural. And the Abyss in The World Below has a more, I think we call it hypogeon or hypogeon, so it has a cosmic horror Lovecraftian element to it, which I suppose is more in keeping with some of that La Sombra stuff from Vampire than the Abyss just being pure nothingness, because you can't play nothingness. You can't, as much as I love the quasi and para elemental planes in second edition D&D, there are very few cases where your character is going to travel to the plane of void, or negative energy plane, I should say, to use its correct name. But you could also have the Abyss in a D&D sense, like the chaotic evil realm of roaming demons. And that, for me, is a little too gonzo comic book-like for The World Below. So our Abyss is like that. Now, the Dark is a kind of mirror image to the Obscura, which is our dreamlands in The World Below. So the Dark is, as the name implies, dark tunnels, dark settlements, caves and so on, that aren't just dark naturally. There is an elemental nature to that darkness. You can enter the dark. There are creatures that only live in the dark. You can illuminate it with spells, but natural light is not going to assist you. And where you end up after transitioning through the dark is anyone's guess. There's portals you don't realize you're about to step through in there. It's one of the most terrifying things in The World Below because the dark moves around. It just consumes tunnels. It doesn't naturally kill you, but it will leave you disorientated. On the other side of that, you have the Obscura, which is more dreamlike, more illuminated, unnaturally so. Will tap into ancestral memories of the world above, things your people may have experienced. And so you'll meet people, go places. Essentially, it's a bit of a loophole for people. It wasn't designed as such, but it works as a loophole for people who don't want their games to be permanently set in the subterranean gloom. With the Obscura, through dreams, you can access any kind of fantasy environment you like. And Chaos is power-wise antithetical to the Abyss. The Abyss is kind of absorption-like, kind of negative energy draining-like, whereas Chaos is pure unbridled, unspooling power that a select few individuals have ultimate control over, but Chaos spits out all over the damn place. There's fonts of it, there's rivers of it, there's rocks, crystallized rocks of it. And this is, to use a term that has of course come up in many games, think something like your mana. But it's an unpredictable kind of mana, hence the name Chaos. Every time you use a chaotic sorcery, you run the risk of a chaotic retaliation, which is the world below's kind of wild magic effect, because I'm the kind of asshole that loves playing wild mages in AD&D 2. It's also got an element of paradox backlash to it from Mage the Ascension. And that, again, that is by intent, except paradox backlash is almost uniformly negative. Chaotic retaliations are not. Sometimes they can benefit you a great deal, and you can even alter on the random tables with all your chaotic retaliations, whether it's going to sort of go up a row or down a row if you have the right powers to affect it. But most of the time you have no ability. You just make the chaotic sorcery attempt. If you don't buy off the complication that comes with it, well, not only have you got the effect you wanted, you've also summoned a cloud, a swarm of carnivorous razorwing insects, and they're not just going to go for the enemy, they're going to go for you as well. Or you might cause structural damage to the cave you are in, or a sudden outgrowth of fungi which could be toxic or whatever. So I know you know me, Keegan. I will ramble on and on and on, as you have experienced on several occasions.
Well, I was going to say that it seems like everyone's kind of understood that magic needs to be a little random. Like Dungeon Crawl Classics has the, once you learn a spell, roll 1d100. That is mm-hmm. the effect that will happen every time you cast the spell. Good luck. Yep. And we had one player who learned Spider Climb, and the random mm-hmm. effect was everyone around you healed 1d6 damage. So he's like, I'm running up to him, and spider climb. Am I climbing the walls? No.
I love that kind of thing because it makes magic seem magical if that's not too redundant to state. And don't get me wrong, I got into role-playing really through D&D, like many people. And so there is something very reassuring about the Vancian magic system. You know what you've got. And most characters in most games of D&D aren't going to be triggering retaliations, repercussions, paradox backlashes, or whatever by throwing a fireball. The fireball is destructive enough. But when I look at games like Mage, The Ascension, and Ars Magica, for that matter, what really attracted me to them, and more as a player than as a storyteller, oddly, because most of the time I will run World of Darkness games. I very rarely play them now, but Mage is a game I always preferred playing, was the fluidity of magic. You could create what you could imagine, and if you created it in just the wrong way, or the most visible way, or vulgar way, you ran a huge risk of a repercussion. And that meant magic felt wild and untamed, and it made your mages feel powerful, even if they were sometimes arrogant, or dare I say it, hubristic, given that as a major element of Mage.
Yeah, that's kind of why I do, it's a kind of good blend with Dungeon Crawl Classics. It's kind of Vancian in that you roll to see if you cast the spell. Mm-hmm. If it succeeds, the spell effect does go off with your random effect, but as your number goes up, your spell gets stronger. So, like, I think if you get, like, a 30 on your magic missile, if you have a piece of someone, you can sympathetically shoot, like, I think it's, like, 100 missiles, each one doing, like, 2d8 to that person. Or fireball, you make the fireball just teleport into the room and it explodes. And but if you roll a 1, then you have to see if the spell goes off on you, or you get a random mutation. Or one of my favorite ones is, like, someone in your party, randomly selected, of course, one of their body parts changes into another randomly rolled animal. So, like, their head can turn into a chicken, or they can get, like, a lizard leg, or... or, like, if you cast an enlarged person spell, everything within 200 feet go to insect size for 24 hours, and you have a new adventure of trying to survive the the mini world. And I kind of like that as a storyteller, game master, whatever proprietary term you prefer, is because it means that the game is so unpredictable that you are surprised.
Yeah. And I can see that isn't for every single story guide, keeper, let's keep rattling through the various GM titles, because some people like to have a definite direction in mind, and for themselves and for the players. And while I think every decent narrator or director wants to, well, needs to be able to improvise to a degree, sometimes a magic spell that can completely turn a game on its head is not what you want. Now, I am not that story guide. I like games that surprise me as the person running it as much as it can surprise the players, because it keeps me on my toes. It keeps me imaginative. I feel like if I am just running a game by rote, whether it's reading something off a page or it's an adventure I've got cemented in my mind because I ran it so many times before, at that point, all I am doing is churning out pretty much automated responses. It's when the players do something unpredictable that really keeps me interested. And for that matter, if you have a system that enables them to do this unpredictable thing, or encourages them to, with things like chaotic retaliations, as we have in The World Below, it makes my enjoyment of being a story guide just ramp up entirely. I want to be excited and interested and wonder what's going to happen next, rather than just predict, okay, in this room we've got this, in the next corridor we've got that. That's, you know, I've done that, and I've, I guess, moved on from it.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. That's what drew me to the OSR, because all the randomness does keep me on my toes. Like, I would do this as a homebrew for The World Below, actually, is I've been thinking of reaction tables, where it's like, if they're this particular monster, put a penalty on that so they're more likely to be hostile, but it's not out of the question to where there might be a peaceful interaction, or if they're...
Yep.
This one, add, etc., and then play around with that, because I have tomes on my PC of just random encounter tables for specific campaigns where it's like, this is lower or higher because they just came back. The random encounter says they came back from a hunting trip, so their HP is lower, so they're less likely to look for a fight, and so you go through this.
So, yeah. That kind of thing is great. I love that. And I love also when you get random tables that provide interesting scenery. Something I often moan about in videos, interviews, and running games is when presented with a random encounter, but there is nothing interesting about your surroundings. So an awful lot of games I have played, and it's not really the fault of the GMs, because they're running what they read, and a lot of the time they're quite new to it, so they think, much like a video game, if you've woken up from your rest and must defend yourself, there's 2d6 ogres and 1d6 trolls accompanying them, which we know, of course, would never happen, but let's bear with it. So we got 2d6 ogres and 1d6 trolls, and you're in an open field. Big deal. You know, that's not exciting. I want to know why a random encounter is interesting is largely based on where it happens. What you said yeah, are they back from a hunting trip? Is one of them injured? Let's say maybe one of them's carrying a magical weapon because they're back from an adventure. There could be lots of things. But I want to know, what kind of leveling have we got in this area? So in other words, is this a patch of oversized fungi? So, you know, you've got mulch at ground level, which is sticky and sinking. You know, you might sink up to ankle deep, maybe even further. There are large mushroom caps, some of which, if you kick them or climb onto them, might spit forth toxic spores and things like that. And you've got some enemies up high. You've got some clinging to the wall. And there's a narrow tunnel to get out, and there's a wide tunnel to get out, but there's a strange sound coming from it. When you start introducing elements like that, for one thing, and I don't know whether it's an accurate memory, whether it's just nostalgia, that's what kind of makes me think back to a lot of the Tunnels and Trolls games I played when I was really getting into role-playing. The idea of, this is an interesting dungeon. It isn't a 30 by 30 room, but that's what I remember. And I remember thinking, and I know a lot of people now are a bit snooty, I think, when it comes to the Forgotten Realms, especially how it's been presented as just the Sword Coast in 4th and 5th edition, more or less. But I remember if it's not over-egging it or being hyperbolic, I remember the sense of wonder I had reading 2nd edition, even 3rd edition, source books for the Forgotten Realms, because of the amount of detail that was given, not just for preset areas and people, but what you could, again, randomly generate and encounter. It made the world feel alive and more important. And we do try to do that in The World Below. And I think we do a decent job. We've received very good feedback so far. Some people, what's most interesting to me, just to briefly touch on the chaotic element again, because it isn't the be-all, end-all. Some people are playing really scared of that chaotic element. You know, they don't want to touch it because they like their predictable gameplay. And that is, again, absolutely fine. Because characters are built to have three sets of powers, you know, you've got your you can have a thesis, a synthesis, and a sorcery. Your thesis is the way you exert yourself on the world. Your synthesis is the way you commune with the world, how it speaks through you. Your sorcery is the way you grip chaos and unleash it. Sorcery, your character could devote all their experience point to building up their sorceries, because they don't come with chaotic retaliations. They are what you might consider subtle magic or coincidental magic. And so you can play the game the way you want. If you want to play it like it's a 3rd edition or 4th edition D&D game, excellent. Go for it. If you want to start getting into the guts of a real basic D&D grind, you can do that as well. I strongly recommend leaning heavily on the sorceries if you'd want to, because an awful lot's going to blow up in your face and your character's going to die, but that's why there's a generational play system, so that you can play your character's brother or son or daughter or best friend when your character dies in, hopefully, a legendary way. And I don't think legendary is always taking down the enemy. I think if a character can have their name etched on a wall as, let's think, Genric the, and it will be the unfortunate, or the consumed by a giant bargle, or here lies Genric, fell to his death into a pit of Arachnida that ate him alive from the feet up because he couldn't reach the lip and climb up. I love that kind of thing. I like lethality because, again, for me, it adds a certain weight to your actions and the world around you.
Yeah, and that's like a game principle I always live by, is if characters are real easy to create, they're very easy to die. And if they're harder to create, then it's usually a little harder to kill them, just because no one likes spending a couple hours making a character.
Definitely.
And some games get that balance a little wrong. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Harnmaster.
Yes, oh yes.
Yeah, where it's just like, hey, are you ready to devote an entire afternoon to make a character who might die of, like, an infection after your first fight?
Not
particularly.
This is one of those, it's really interesting you bring that up, because I'm a big fan of Chronicles of Darkness, of course I am, I've worked on enough of them, I think on every one of them at some point or other, at this point, and one Chronicles of Darkness game that I won't name, bear in mind that I have worked on all of them, so I know the system. I know, in theory, how to create characters really quickly. because I know where to go, I know how to navigate the book. One of those games took my group and I 2 sessions to create our characters. And yes, we were chatting and we were snacking and there were distractions. We weren't just head down reading the books and we had one book to share between us. But it took us about 6 hours. And what that told us, interestingly, was, okay, so these are characters we're supposed to play for a very long time. And I know that that is the common mentality with most World of Darkness and Chronicles of Darkness games, because they're storytelling first and foremost. Most people don't create a vampire with a 6-page backstory just to have them eaten by the Sabbat in the first session. But I like the risk that that could happen. I like the risk that if your character does something silly or makes a particularly bad roll, especially if they make a particularly bad roll a couple of times in a row, I think that's where it generally plays for me. 1 botch isn't going to kill you. 2 botches in a row, okay, now you're losing a leg. If not a bit more. Again, it adds a bit of spice, excitement to a game that everyone predicts is going to preserve the character forever. And as soon as I'm faced with a character creation system that takes me 6 hours, and there aren't many of them out there, but they do exist. And yeah, Handmaster is definitely among them. And I, in fact, I would go so far as to say I mentioned A Song of Ice and Fire. That's quite a long, convoluted system, but mainly because the first time you do it, you're creating your fiefdom as well. But it's still pretty damn long. It makes me as the GM reticent to kill the characters because I don't want to put the players through that. And it makes me as a player very cautious about what I'm going to do. Again, on a subconscious level, because I don't want to put myself through that again.
Yep.
So, yeah. Give me quick character creation any day, because if I choose to be ultra careful with my character at that point, I can play someone who will last a long time. But if I decide I want to play a bombastic, to go a bit Forgotten Realmsy, a bombastic fighter cleric of Tempest, or to go world blowy, a absolutely blood crazed hunter Aprician, cladding himself in the bones and chitin of various insects that he's slain, he just wants to kill the next great thing. I know that my character's going to probably end up dead, but at least it'll go out in an interesting way, and it didn't take me longer than 20 minutes to create the poor bastard.
No, that's fair. We took a bit longer, and that was because I got a good mix. As I told you when I was getting the group together, we had one person who really knew Story Path, mm-hmm. 2 that had done World of Darkness, and then 2 people mostly in the D20s.
Yeah.
Realm. And so I'd mentioned in the tail end review section, I'd be curious to see as you get more experience how much this speeds up.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, that was one of my I think my only big criticism on the character creation is this takes at least with our group, it took a bit of time. And I cut out parts because I didn't want to give the entire chapter away as I was reading it aloud to people.
I think especially a first time coming into it, it makes sense when you've got a game, especially where you can have characters that are from specific locations. So I think that is what takes people the longest with The World Below in the feedback I've received. When you get to specifically putting your Dawn together, because you have your 3 paths. You have your Dawn, your Dialectic, and your Calling. And your Calling is your class, your role. That's easy. Pretty much everyone comes in, no matter how high and mighty they claim to be. If they come in to play Vampire, they have a clan in mind, even if they have this great mortal concept. If they come into the World Below, they probably know what Calling they want to play early on. Dialectic is a kind of mutation that's going on. It could be physical, it could be spiritual, but this is the way your character is transforming based on the world around you. There's only 6 options. So, you know, it's again pretty easy. Now, your Dawn is your dogma, so what you believe, your ancestry, biological or all, adopted, or the culture you grew up in, but it's ancestry, your community or settlement, so the place you come from, and your guild, which is essentially your profession. Who is hiring you to go out on these adventures? That's all within the Dawn part of character creation. We deliberately put that at the front of character creation because we feel that deciding a character's origins should have a big impact on how your character behaves. I'm a huge proponent, I suppose, of characters being more defined by their surroundings than their biology. I'll do a sidebar on this in a moment, but because you have to select these four elements and there is an assumption that you know a little bit about the game, and this will of course be easier once the book is in people's hands and they can quickly flick to a part of it rather than opening up different documents, when it asks you what settlement are you from, and there's a list, we all know, well, you and I, Keegan, know that in those Vampire the Masquerade and Werewolf the Apocalypse books, and you got your two-page character creation quick chart thing, and it has your list of tribes, let's say, with a one-line description. That's enough for us, because we've read these books to death. But someone coming into the world below you is going to look at something like Telva's Hearth, or Mud Town, or Tark, or Fortress, and they'll have their sentence right up, and they won't be sure that that's what they want, so they want to do a little more digging into it, and it will take time. And that's all right, because the next time they create a character, it will be quicker.
I think that the big part that tripped us up to, and this is not a slight on the book itself, it's a slight on the document, is the quick tables and the character creation that have the little dots and all that. Their formatting just made my eyes cross. I'm like, oh, I guess I'm going to the right chapter.
Now, so the reason for that formatting, I mean, I'm a little behind the curtain thing here, is to make Word translate easily into PDF, because, of course, eventually we're going to translate into PDF. You have your tabs between the columns of your tables. The problem is that when you have certain columns, the rows on certain columns have more words on than others, it makes them all fall out of line with each other and you just can't read the damn thing. So I acknowledge that. It's unfortunate because, yeah, we've got to provide people the manuscript in this format, but I'll see if I can't figure something out for the people who have got access to the preview just to make it a little easier to pass. But something I was going to mention on Ancestry, it was a hot button issue a couple of years ago. It seems to have died down largely now. Although, interestingly, it came up a little in Werewolf 5th Edition, this idea of ancestry being determinant, and whether you back away from it entirely, whether you embrace it fully with all the cultural stereotypes that can come with it, or whether you accept it at face value and just say, well, this is just a piece of flavour on my character, I'm not going to read any more deeply into this. And obviously you can go any which way, and there isn't any way that's wrong, though your tastes may vary. But I felt, so the number of times I've created an elf in D&D because I want a dexterity bonus, and I don't think any more of it than that, but I can absolutely see if you are really trying to analyze the socio and potentially socioeconomic, the cultural issues within a setting, if you're trying to look at a coherent game world, and there is a race, so to speak, that has -2 intelligence from birth, that implies something. And if you can start connecting all that to real world cultures, that implies something quite bad. In a way, it's not so offensive to have someone have a strength or dexterity or constitution modifier, but yeah, as soon as you start implying a certain group is genetically predisposed to be less intelligent, less wise, or less charismatic, you are making a judgment that doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. Now, to go back to what I was saying, however, if you accept it at face value, if you're not looking into it, if all you're doing is putting stats on a sheet and your character comes later, and this is the difference, I don't think those modifiers are a bad thing. But, and this isn't to say you shouldn't dig into it, it depends on how closely linked to the real world your game is. That's when things will start breaking down, I think, if you start having parallels to real world cultures especially. The World Below handles it through ancestry, which I mentioned doesn't have to be biological. every element of your Dawn path gives you something. So, for instance, your guild and your settlement, so your profession and where you come from, are the things that are more likely than not going to be defining your attributes and your skills, because this is how you've been trained. This is the culture around you. This is the job you have trained for. Your dogma, so your beliefs, and your ancestry, they govern what motivates you, what you're going to be getting your momentum from, what you're going to be getting bonus experience points from. Because what that's telling us is you have been told, for instance, in the case of ancestry, maybe your parents or your grandparents told you a story about this cave far away where diamonds grew out of the walls and were so easily chipped off that everyone who lived around there was incredibly wealthy or something like that. And you could have, as a momentum generator or an experience-based aspiration, find the cave diamonds. That doesn't make your character stronger, weaker, less smart, more smart than anyone else. It is saying your character's background, your character's origins, affect them in the same way that our parents, our teachers in our world affect us and the directions we take in life. And I think it's a more elegant way, not to blow my own trumpet, but I think it's a more elegant way of presenting who you are and where you're from than simply saying, I'm from here, therefore I must be, or my parents were this, therefore I must be stronger.
No, that doesn't
work biologically.
No, I agree with that.
It's an interesting topic, you know. I can talk about it to death.
I could too. I've had comments because with the James video about werewolf I got a lot of, you're reading too much into it. You sound like conspiracy theorists talking about, like, you know, socioeconomic motivations behind the game. And I'm like, look, man, we're just going to have to be real. World of Darkness was born out of left-wing ideology. That's just a fact. Yeah. But D&D was born out of right-wing ideology. That is also just a fact. Gary Gygax was put colonialism in the game. That is the main mode of operation in old-school D&D. And if you want to remove that, you got to do some work. And if you don't want to do that work, and like you said, just put numbers on the sheet, I get it. But don't ask people to keep creating games without any thought put into that.
No. In a way, I feel like you can't sell, well, you probably could, but I doubt it would attract the right crowd. You can't really sell a game with a banner that says this game is apolitical, or in this game the stats don't matter, but you've got to create them anyway. There are people who make games like that, and typically by declaring their games are apolitical, they are in fact hugely offensive. I'm sure that isn't the case in every case, but it certainly is in more than one that I've read. The werewolf issue is one that is really interesting to me because I worked with James on Werewolf 5th Edition back when it was with Hunters Entertainment. James and I weren't tightly bound or anything. We weren't in the... we may have been on one chapter mutually, but that may have been it. But I was certainly aware that what James was saying afterwards was true. That about the ideas that James came up with in the formation of Werewolf 5th Edition. And I still have a very mixed relationship with Werewolf the Apocalypse, because it's only in recent time that I've come to look a little dimly on the game. And it isn't because of 5th Edition necessarily, though I think it's played a part. So I want to unpack it a little. I think that Werewolf was in a rather damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, and I think that Mage of the Ascension will be even more so if they do a 5th edition of it, because they have there's an awful lot of cultural stereotypes in both games. Now, the way they handled it in Werewolf 5th edition was, of course, to try and extricate themselves from those cultural stereotypes absolutely. And they do it in some places, they're a bit hand-wavy in others, but what they mostly do is extract themselves from the cultural stereotypes that could get them in trouble. And as a business, I completely get why. And from an ethics standpoint, I get that by doing this, they can say, we're not being offensive, and I get why. Where things get really interesting from an observer's perspective, because I didn't work on the finished 5th edition of Werewolf, is seeing the fan outrage or backlash or upset or frustration. Because there's an awful lot of people who got into Werewolf, the Apocalypse, because their culture was represented. This was in the 90s, of course, and we can forgive a lot for happening in the 90s, but we can also look back on it with the wisdom of 2023 and say, well, there are certain things that need changing. So there are people who, let's say, Irish-American, and Irish-Americans often have a strong connection to their Irish heritage, as much as the Irish love it. The Irish-Americans are arguably more Irish than the Irish, in some cases. And so there were a lot of Irish-American role players that saw the Fianna, as they were called then, and felt a deep personal connection to the tribe. They wanted to play this because it was connected to them. And I have no doubt the same occurred in some cases with the Native American-based tribes. I can't speak for whether that happened with the Slavic-based tribes. I'm not embedded enough in that community. But, you know, you look at various tribes and what they represented, and there were certain people that found a home there. And so they are looking at what Werewolf 5th Edition is, and they're saying, well, you've drained the love out of this. You've drained what I was attracted to out of this. And there are other people who still quite rightly come in, and this is the problem. Everyone can be right to different degrees, who say, well, yes, I acknowledge that you were drawn to the Fianna. However, there are some Irish and Irish Americans who see this as a word that we shouldn't use, a stereotype and a cultural piece of mythology or legend or belief that we shouldn't be using, especially due to relatively modern political troubles, to use a rather loaded word. So you get almost the same side arguing with itself over whether this content can be included. And I have no doubt there would have been a way, with authors like James and other incredibly talented writers, where the Gale Stalkers, where the Heart Wardens, where the Geta Fenris could have been included as well, with still maintaining cultural touchstones without being negative cultural stereotypes. It would have been difficult, very difficult, and I'm sure some people would have been hurt regardless. But to go back to what I was saying originally, I can absolutely see why Paradox shied away from that and thought, you know what, no, we're not taking that risk. It's probably too expensive, too time-consuming, too risky. Look at all the other explosions we've had dealing with the World of Darkness. And I guess I have the privilege of being a white male British observer on this, so I'm not likely to get offended by any of this. But while I can acknowledge that there is material that is offensive, Paradox, since taking over the World of Darkness, or the White Wolf properties more broadly, have come under fire on more than a handful of occasions for handling something the right way or the wrong way, usually the wrong way. And I'm not absolving the company. I'm not saying it's not Paradox's fault. But what I am going to say, and the but is the problem here, I appreciate that. What I am going to say is, these properties are loaded. The Paradox, I don't think, again, I think there were ways to do things in an utterly sensitive and still playable fashion. Or, in fact, I wouldn't even call it sensitive. I'd call it a very mature and playable fashion. But given what happened with the Chechnya situation, the some brouhaha embrace from the ranks of neo-Nazis situation, South American cartels or death squad situation, there's a lot that's going on there, and this is an issue you face when you're setting a horror game in a contemporary world and trying to pull on real world sources. they are stuck behind between a rock and a hard place, but they can't be given a free pass for that because it's their choice to do it. They can choose to do it another way as well.
No, true. And I'm a white person, you know, so some of these issues will not touch in the same way that others do for me. And it's just a, and I've said this before elsewhere, is I think my biggest problem with Paradox is, and their handling, especially of Werewolf, is the choice to appropriate revolutionary language to push a very status quo message in Werewolf.
Yeah. Myth.
And I think that was the biggest issue. That was one of the bigger issues. I think the biggest issue is how they, through what James put out, how they treated their authors, what they did with art. I think that's the biggest issue. And those are issues that exist even if the game was, in my opinion, good.
Yeah.
And
you're right. You are correct. Those were utterly stupid errors. And yeah, again, not absolving them for any of that. It's unfortunate because I feel like I know. Well, to take The World Below for example, because I know that is the cause of this interview. Why we're talking about this. We explore revolution in that game. It's a fundamental part of the game. And the reason is because as an amateur historian, I am an amateur, but I am a very keen amateur historian of the Russian Revolution from about the period 1905 to about 1953 or thereabouts. So starting with the Winter Revolution and working your way toward the death of Stalin, not the movie, though it is very good. And so I've been a long time enthusiast, I suppose, of figuring out the levers of power that resulted in the Bolsheviks coming to power, the purges that happened, the mass famines that happened, forced collectivization, all of these things. And I say this as someone who is probably considered a fuzzy leftist. I'm not a communist, but I am incredibly interested in the repeat attempts to form an ideology, impose an ideology, through things like mass repression, lack of pluralization, mass terror, and things like that, that is still somehow acclaimed by people as better than what was going on the other side of the world. And so I use that kind of knowledge, because, again, revolution generally interests me, to say, well, what are the political situations? What are the setups in the world below? Let's say we have this dozen or so well liches. I know this is where we start getting fantastical, and at some point the center doesn't hold, but we have our well liches holding onto the reins of chaos, our power source. The closer you are to the well, the more power you have. The further away you are, the less the trickle down gets to you. There are various settlements throughout the world below. Some have syndicalist kind of governments because they are council-based and artifice-based. You have autocracies run by a monarch, an absolute monarch in some cases, a constitutional monarch in others. And this isn't just my way of putting every kind of governmental system from democracies to communist to socialist and every other damn thing in the game. It's to say, if your characters or your characters' ancestors were driven down from the surface into new worlds, into new settlements, you lost much of any attachment to what you had before, but you're still going to have some of the same beliefs. With miles of tunnels separating from you, you're going to have all these microcosms of revolution and political experiment. People want to find the best ways to survive in a hostile world, because this is a world that wants to destroy you. And therefore, the idea is proposed in the game of, there are all these adventurers who want to descend all the way to the well, to the heart of power, wrest it from the well liches, and spread it to the deserving. And so there's a very clear sort of communist revolution or Bolshevik revolution idea there. Now, they are then presented with the issue, the same issue one could argue the Bolsheviks were presented with from 1917 to like 1933, of, well, now that you have that power, how exactly are you going to spread it? Are you going to try giving it to everyone equally? in a utopic way. What happens when you meet someone who wants to take more than their share? Do you punish them with death? Do you deny them power entirely? When there are some settlements that are hostile and some that are passive and some that are generous, does someone get more than another? Who governs who is more deserving? Is it based on who can accumulate the most resources? We look at it from a... and I'm sorry if this gets very much into the sort of Russian revolutionary weeds, but the idea that Lenin and Bukharin were following in the early 1920s of the new economic policy. Capitalism in the countryside, communism in the cities. In other words, the farmers can set their prices, but the people who work for industry abide by the same, essentially, flat level. And so you can look at all of these things through the lens of the world below and play some really interesting long-form stories to say, well, how does that socioeconomic change occur in this confined, this powder keg environment? Because it also comes down to personalities. I'm no great believer in the great man of history theory, but what happens when you have a particularly strong autocrat who is able to keep their population in check? And this is the kind of person who probably doesn't allow many people to migrate, probably doesn't allow many refugees to pour in, but says, I look after my people perfectly well. I don't need your handouts. Is that person wrong in this paradigm? Because who can say, you know, ethically speaking, in a kind of post-apocalyptic environment? World of Darkness, to get back to what you were saying, because again, I will talk at length. Werewolf has... or had, I would say, that conundrum in everything up to Werewolf 20. It's, let's say you can take down the worm. Let's say you can do a deep blow to the Weaver or the Worm or one of Pentex's subsidiaries. What's the fallout from that? How are you going to reconstruct what you've just destroyed? How are you going to make a better world? And are the people you are imposing this better world on going to want that better world? Are you going to force them to your way of life, or are you going to try subtly educating them? It's the idea of, should, when there is a war zone in the real world, we, the Western world, I'm speaking to the Western world right now on GM Talks, should we, the Western world, be dropping first aid packages, educational pamphlets, and people, missionaries, into places that are being bombed flat, where people are suffering horribly? Or should we recognize global borders, international division, set up first aid stations, Red Cross, and so on, only at the border, and if people want that help, they've got to come and get it? It, and then do you trust the people within that country to spread it equally again, or do they hoard it for themselves? All of these questions have been asked in Werewolf the Apocalypse, especially out of all the World of Darkness games. It's one of the things that attracted me to it. It's something that I have tried to put in the world below to the best of my ability, and I think, again, we do a mature job of it. And I do try and avoid that word sensitive, which I mentioned earlier, because I think it's a word that can be misread.
Well, I think I agree, only because it's just like treating someone with respect is somehow sensitive is kind of a bullshit notion.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you've said it much more clearly than I would. But yeah, when it comes to World 5th, I don't see that same conundrum, that unentangleable, if that's a word, disentangleable, not anymore. It seems a very straightforward game, much the same as Hunter the Reckoning for 5th edition seems a very straightforward game. Vampire, I don't think, is in 5th edition, but Werewolf has, to be very poetic about it, lost its fangs, maybe, by having some of that flavour drawn out of it. For, I expect, fear of putting too many noses out of joint. Believe me, I'm not some colossal... I'm not the sort of person that's ever going to say free speech just so I can say something offensive. And I would like to emphasize, to handle Werewolf 5th edition in the correct way, in a way that would appeal to everyone, if that is even possible, would be a monumental task. And I do think Mage of the Ascension would be even an even harder one, if you're to have it resemble Mage in any way.
Yeah, and well, in an imperfect world with imperfect people, you will never create perfect art. And that's just something people have to understand. And I think I got to quote Josh Heath on the Werewolf front before we go back to the World Below, because I do have other questions about the World Below. Is I think Josh Heath is the one who told me that the best part about Werewolf is that it sells itself on a splatterpunk style game, and the existential horror of Werewolf is that the splatterpunk is not enough.
Yeah. He puts it very elegantly indeed.
So to history then, because Ed Greenwood was a librarian at one point. What kind of breadth of information did he bring to the World Below that you think really helped elevate the setting and the game for you?
Wow. Well, working with Ed Greenwood was a dream come true. I've had the opportunity to game with him before. I've spoken with him before on my YouTube channel back when it was sort of a prolific hub of videos. Now I do about 2 a week. The chance to work with Ed was fantastic, and I wanted him working primarily on setting and monstrous ecologies. And it wasn't just so he could play in his ballpark. I know, of course, he created the Forgotten Realms, and he's created it incredibly well, and he has worked on a lot of other games as well. I think, in a way, it's unfair put him purely as the Forgotten Realms creator. Obviously, that's had a lot of creators added to it since. I'm a big fan of Ed's Falconfar novel series, too. And I know he's been working very hard with Fate of the Norns, which is another good game. But when he came up with a whole load of the settlements that you can read about in The World Below, I basically gave him the challenge of, obviously, I set the scene of the world around him, and I said that I wanted every single setting to essentially have a story hook on every paragraph, if not every single sentence that you write about it. There has to be something that you could call out and say, I could set a story here or about this place. And what's more, none of them can seem like the other. They all, one of the big risks of the World Below is people will picture it as just stone walls, stalagmites, stalactites, and bugs. And the settlements, while transitional areas definitely can have that element, they should at some point, we have settlements in diverse biomes. We have our crystalline caves, we have our fungal caves, we have our settlements built on stilts over acidic lakes. You know, we've got all this weird and wonderful things, rivers of mercury and so on. And I said to Ed, every single one of these places you write about needs to be in a different geological environment, essentially. As well as its environment, and in terms of fauna and flora. And good Lord, did he deliver, because after I set the brief for him, I think it was about 2 days later, he sent me his first settlement. He just said, how about this? I thought, oh, okay. This is something I could have never imagined when I was reading it. I think it's the settlement of Rehu. And this is one of the ones where there's a whole... There's gems being put in people's eye... to replace people's eyeballs, I think. Or it's the place that's built out of a huge sort of fleshy web. And people are slowly turning into the arachnid inhabitants or something like that. And it's all of these weird and wonderful things that Ed brings as a natural world builder. And I think it was important for me to provide the direction. And I hope he didn't see them as constraints, but... as a designer, constraints or direction are useful because, you know, you need to know what your barriers are, and hopefully they will fuel your imagination. And Michele Masala wrote all the monsters up. Ed added a lot to them in terms of their ecologies, because, again, it was incredibly important to me that the creatures in the World Below weren't just colossal stag beetles and giant worms. They exist in there, and they're great fun to fight, ride, or otherwise kill for resources, because worm meat is good meat. But yeah, the fact that we have our Hemexy vampiric, the sort of Byzantine vampiric crustacean-like creatures with mosquito-like proboscis. We have our Clothar, which are our mind flayer-like creatures from the abyss that are sort of tar-like, that can wear the faces of other people after they absorb them. So there's a bit mind flayer, a bit doppelganger-y. We have all kinds of strange creatures with an understandable ecology written behind them. We haven't released all those ecologies yet, and we're hoping to put them all in one book. We're called Ed Greenwood's Monstrous Ecology for the World Below. And I think we've already funded part of that with the Backer Kit campaign for the World Below. So, yeah, Ed always delivers in terms of imagination. It doesn't have as much of his kinky stuff in it as some of his material, but I'm never...
I wasn't going to bring up the joke, but now that you got me started.
I'm never against Ed putting a bit of kinkiness in his content, because something a lot of people miss, and I think sometimes, you know, and I know we keep cycling back or steering back around to looking at World of Darkness, but I'm going to mention this one thing. One of my favorite things to do when I was working on the World of Darkness, and I'm not really working on it now, but other than on one of the board games, is the humor. There was also an incredibly satirical, biting humor. Sometimes it was puerile, but there was a nice satirical element to it. And I feel that isn't there as much in 5th edition. It wants to make a colder, starker impression. And I'd say it succeeds in a lot of cases. But I like the humour, for my taste. And therefore, when Ed puts funny little characters with funny names, or someone... One of my favourite things, because this is a reflection of history, you have King Edward IV of England... He had lots of siblings, but his two main brothers were Richard of Gloucester, who went on to become Richard III. Very loyal, very, very good brother. Would always trust him with my nephews. But he also had George, Duke of Clarence. And George was constantly flipping and flopping sides in the Wars of the Roses. And in the end, King Edward basically has him executed. Because George comes back to him, Edward says, this is like the third time, I can't trust you anymore, you're my brother, I love you, but you've got to go. And when people ask him, what happened to George? He says, he drowned in a butt of Malmsey wine, and has a laugh and a drink. And that's because George was a colossal drunk, or is believed he was an indulgent sort of individual. And those... stories that are written, chronicled in history about someone who was noble and, as far as history records, was drowned in a barrel of wine. If that happened or not is irrelevant. Ed brings that kind of flavour that can look strange. You might look askance at it when you're reading it, but carries a certain reality to it that we all experience. It's the same of, you know, the horrors of the Donald Trump presidency. We were all sat here, I say all, a lot of us were recoiling from it. We thought America has never been worse than this presidentially. And obviously people sometimes forget the James Madisons of the world, but let's say in the modern era, the presidency has never been so god-awful. And yet... there is a car crash element to it as well. There is a reason we watch. There is a reason we like to mock the Four Seasons fiasco and all that. These things happen, and so they need to happen in games like The World Below or worlds we want to have some grounding in reality. It can't always be drab and miserable, and Ed always brings an air of whimsy, even to his horror, which is a careful measure. You know, you can't. It's not easy to do.
Yeah, and I think it's in the Anthropocene Review, or him talking about it. I'm not sure if you're familiar with John Green.
Mm-hmm.
He said that fiction, it might have been Hank actually, that said fiction is so much easier to write because everything happens for a reason in fiction. But when you read history, just bonkers shit happens that sounds made up. But if you put that in a book, people would go, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that was the problem of the last, I guess, 7 years in America. It was the how do I satirize this? It's gone past the point of satire, but clearly not, because again, you have those elements like the four seasons, which I suppose we could look back at and say, the reason we all laughed so hard was because we knew he'd lost at that point. I wonder how we would have responded if that had been where they'd celebrated their victory genuinely instead of...
I think we would have still laughed, but it would have been to avoid crying at that point.
Yeah.
And then because you made the Edward Greenwood kink joke, I have to bring up the great Ed Greenwood meme that I saw once, which is like, they start doing like little clips of his kinky stuff, and then it was like, Ed Greenwood, come down to the basement, there's a con for you, and it's him getting sealed into the wall going, and did you hear about the drow matriarchs and the whips? Yes, Ed Greenwood, the drow whip sex parties.
I'm sure that's how he wants to go.
But yeah, no, I just to bring it back home, I really like this setting. I think it's great. I think it's a good, even if it wasn't 100% your goal, and James talks about it at the end of our video too, of their own review, is though, you know, slip-ups may happen, I think this was a genuine and good attempt to try and decolonize D&D and fantasy in a way that the main modus operandi is not find the foreigners, kill them, take their stuff, and then come back as heroes.
No, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because this is another thing that we had to handle with maturity, and I'm glad we did. Your characters, the most part, most of them, are going to be descended from refugees. The world above was destroyed by some manner or other, or rendered unlivable, at least. And so thousands of people descended into the world below in various places. And the world below wasn't uninhabited when they arrived. There were people already living there. And monsters as well, things we might consider monsters. And those people who were already there, the original inhabitants, with their various cultures, could have very easily basically said, no, you know, fuck you. You're not taking our caves, our already limited resources, and taking up all this space. And I think one of the cultures we present in the game... didn't do that, but certainly backed away. Certainly said, we're not helping, we're just retreating further into the dark and seeing what happens. But another one, the Chilzil, who are an original group from the world below, they took a view that was in part charitable and in part pragmatic. The charitable aspect is, we know you're not here to invade, we know you're fleeing, and therefore we will give you what we can, and everything will basically even out in the end. If we all have to struggle for a while so that you can survive, that's what we'll do. And that is, of course, the kind of moral decision you'd hope people would make in the real world too. But there was also the pragmatic view of, well, if we just leave all these people outside of our caves to die of starvation and get picked off by giant bugs and other creatures, all we're really going to be doing is feeding the monsters. All we're going to be doing is strengthening them by letting them feed on all these desperate people. And a big stack of corpses outside your door is a very good way of attracting scavengers, disease, and so on. So they felt obliged as well. But the one thing that doesn't happen during the Great Descent, at least not chronicled in the core book, is any original culture trying to push them back to the world above. I didn't think that would be fun or interesting, and almost it would be a little predictable, because there's a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction where you have your raiders and your hostile communities. I mean, The Walking Dead had a new one every two seasons, didn't it? And I just thought that's done. Now, where that frames you as a protagonist, a descendant of one of these refugee cultures, more likely than not, is interesting. Because you may be several generations removed from the Great Descent. You don't know how your ancestors suffered and struggled or worked in concert with the Chilzil or whoever it is they encountered. how they agree to share spoils or the limited resources, you may have that sense of entitlement. You may think these caves are just as much ours as they were the people who came here before us. You may still feel indebted. You may feel like you owe a permanent debt, an obligation even, to protect them. I want that question asked, because the Chilzil have definitely lost a lot of the territories they called their own. They've lost access to a lot of resources. They've probably lost a lot of people as a result. And so you as players have the decision through your characters. Well, what are you going to do about that? The idea of playing conquistadors arriving on the shores of Mazateca or North America it goes back to what you mentioned very early on about Gygax sort of colonialization, I should say. And I don't think we need more of that unless it can be taught in a very interesting and novel way. I'm not the person to write that novel approach to colonialization, I don't think, because I don't have that view, and I think it would come across as too... I certainly wouldn't come across as exceptional, because exceptionalism is, you know, a blight. It certainly was in the late 19th century, and it isn't much better now. So, putting your characters in the role of descendants of refugees, without making you the refugees themselves, gives you a sort of dichotomous position of what is your reaction to the people, what is your reaction to the place, what do you consider monsters, what do you consider yours, and it comes back to some of those political questions. And I know not everyone likes to ask political questions in RPGs. You don't have to play a character that asks these things, but you can if you want to. And if you want to, there's a lot you can explore in the game, I think.
Yep, and I've said this before on the page. I don't think I've ever said it on recording, and if I hadn't, my apologies, is that every game's political. It's just that, you know, whether you want to question your own politics or play with them. And if you don't, that's fine. Don't have to every time, but just be aware that it's still political, even if it doesn't rankle your feathers.
Yeah, I think, in fact, that is true. It's true for any media. One could argue there are some particularly strange strains of art that avow politics. But if it's media involving dialogue and action or acting, you're likely to... These characters are going to be coming from somewhere. Now, where I think to put words in the mouths of the people who say, I want an apolitical game, is... It isn't that they want the game to be apolitical, it's they want to be able to engage with it in a way where they don't have to think about the politics. And I think you can. It goes back to that idea of, are these numbers just numbers on a sheet, or do they tell me something about my character? You can play a game without engaging with that level of detail. You can just roll dice, play your character, they're in a bubble, if you like, or within a small community, if you like. They have no agency beyond, I'm going out here and doing what I want to do, lone wolf style. And that is a valid form of play. But to expect the games themselves to not have an implicit message in the way they have been written, in the world that they are presenting, in the cultures they're presenting, in the threats that exist, is ludicrous. It's fanciful. And to my tastes, I prefer to engage in things that have a political question. I don't want to engage in something that is a political hammer, treating me like an anvil, because I don't derive enjoyment from being bludgeoned over the head. I want to question things. I want to pick things apart. I want to find the flaws in things. And yeah, that's where I hope games like The World Below... it's probably why I was always so attracted to Planescape in D&D. I've not read the 5th edition version, but I loved the 2nd edition. The Planescape campaign setting and its various books. While now we can compare it to a lot of games and say the way the factions are presented is incredibly heavy-handed, because it is, and their assignment, or a lot of their assignments, were alignment as well. And I like alignment, actually. I'm it's where I don't agree with a lot of my colleagues. I think alignment is a fantastic tool, but it doesn't carry the nuance. The Planescape factions don't necessarily have the nuance, at least at face value, with, let's say, a World of Darkness splat, for the most part, anyway. But as a young gamer reading the factions in Planescape, I was blown away that things like the Bleak Cabal and the Dustmen and the Free League and the Fated could exist in this world, because there was nothing like that in any other D&D world. There was never that level of philosophy. As simplistic as a lot of those philosophies were, it made you think about the world, and of course your thoughts shape the world around you, just as in Mage the Ascension. And you can easily see how or why TSR created Planescape as a rebuttal, if you like, not a rebuttal, their version of the World of Darkness. It was their... They did it expressly. It's written in one of my histories of D&D that I've got somewhere. It was written expressly due to the success of the World of Darkness. And you can see those connections.
Oh, yeah.
I still love it. I still love reading Planescape material, because I think that material is so rare in D&D. And if I can bring any of that into games like The World Below, or any of the games I write, I'm a happy person.
Excellent. Well, Matthew, thank you for joining us. That was a good talk. I know it's getting late. So
I'm certainly getting plunged into darkness over here. But
yeah.
thank you so much for having me, Keegan. And I know I shouldn't apologize for speaking, but I know that I speak at length, and I do hope that's held the interest of some of your listeners, because, yeah, I always have an awful lot to say.
But Matthew, where do you want to be found on the internet?
Oh, okay, on the internet.
Don't dox yourself on my program to all three listeners.
People can find me on MatthewDawkins.com or on the Onyx Path Discord. That's always a good place to check out and speak to me about any of the games I work on. The thing I want people to check out, the Backer Kit campaign for The World Below, has about a week left. When this goes out, it will be just under a week. So please do check it out while you still can. We keep hitting stretch goals. The book is beautiful. That's the one thing we didn't speak about. The art in this that we've put on display so far is really striking. I think it's some of the best art we've ever had produced. And utilizes the talents of John Cobb as well, whose art drew me into Wraith the Oblivion many, many years ago. So do check it out. I'd very much appreciate it.
Thank you. And I'm Keegan, Bunch of Gamers. You can find us on Facebook, YouTube, Podbean, but I'm not on X, never was, and I was right from the beginning. Thank you for listening.